Hello and welcome to CIFAR Sounding. I'm your host, Simba Wiltz.
And I'm Asla Gonser.
CIFAR Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of the big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At CIFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
You can find out more about us on our website at cflar.org.
We're also on social media. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cflar and on Twitter at cflarbigcats.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/CFL Animal Reserve.
Conservation is at the core of CIFAR's mottos, and we've done a number of shows on this topic. For this one, we decided to bypass conventional research and head straight to the source to talk with one of the world's foremost tiger conservationists. Dr. Rajesh Gopal has had multiple roles in tiger conservation. In his 37-year career, he has worked both in the field and institutionally to advocate for India's tigers. He just completed his role as the Secretary General of India's National Tiger Conservation Authority, coordinating conservation efforts across the country. He is now Secretary General of the Global Tiger Forum, an intergovernmental organization of tiger range countries. We reached Dr. Gopal at his office in New Delhi to discuss tiger conservation. A word of warning for listeners. Due to phone constraints, some of the conversation may be hard to hear in places, but in the interest of accurately conveying the message, we have elected to forego overdubbing so that you can hear Dr. Gopal in his own words. His passion for wild tigers is clear, and we are pleased to have the opportunity to correspond regarding the recent progress in tiger populations.
We asked Dr. Gopal how this census was carried out.
Yes. Well, this was a country-level snapshot assessment which is done once in every 4 years. The periodicity is 4 years. We have 18 states out of 36 states and union territories in India where we have wild tigers. Now, the survey is done once in 4 years and carried out in collaboration with the staff, the state staff, the people who manage these tiger areas on a day-to-day basis.
What we learned from Dr. Gopal was that this is a huge effort that takes place between both federal and state agencies, as well as a number of non-governmental agencies that have all participated on a no-cost basis to make this study happen. He went on to tell us a little bit more about the study design.
Well, this consists of three phases, and prior to this there is a training phase as well. So the training is imparted to the frontline staff in these tiger reserves, which more than 10,000 people you can see. And then there is a capacity building for data assimilation also. And then a lot of remote sensing data is used. There are three phases basically in this exercise, which is a very massive exercise. So in phase one, we get the distribution of evidences, signs, and so many ancillary related information which are important to testify the presence of tiger. This includes the evidences of prey animals as well, human disturbances as well. This gives an idea of the spatial spread of all species, including the tiger, along with the disturbance and the quality of the habitat.
When he had first mentioned this part of the study, I was a little confused. So can you tell us a little bit more about what he means by understanding the spatial spread?
Well, sure. If you think about trying to study tigers in all of India, they can't study the entire country. That would just take way too many resources and too many people. So the first step is to establish the silhouette of the areas where the tigers might be so that they can begin to narrow down their search.
And that's what he's talking about, understanding where the disturbances are found.
And all of these disturbances have to be fed into a very sophisticated system of record.
Now everything, all this is taken, the data is recorded in a standardized format. There's a protocol, 8D protocol for this. And it's done in the GIS, incorporated in the GIS, put in the GIS domain. This generates the indices, that is the relative abundance.
So at this portion of the study, what he's talking about is taking all of this data and having it overlaid using this GIS, global, it's not global, what is
geographic.
It? Geographic. Using this GIS, geographic information system, which essentially allows you to overlay data on top of a map, correct?
Right. And in the States, one of the more common uses that people see the GIS used in is property appraisal. So if you go to the property appraiser's site, you would oftentimes see a GIS that would show the layers of lots and parcels and owners and landlines and whatnot. It's the same system, but this time being used for conservation effect.
Right. And so now they take all of this huge amount of data that shows disturbances and overlaid over this map, and then they have all that data being processed by a lot of people to determine where the phase two of the study is going to continue.
Naturally, and this is obviously critical because if they don't get the right footprint, then they won't be able to complete the study.
So that was phase one, where the end product is the relative abundance and the indices. Mm-hmm. Then coming to the next phase, in the phase two, it's a more easier thing in the sense the Wildlife Institute of India gets the remotely sensed data in the GIS, that is the geographical information system. The disturbance layers are incorporated, that is the human footprints, the proximity to roads, the proximity to cities, metros, and other infrastructures, whatever disturbs the presence of a tiger. And then an idea of wildlife habitat is obtained, which is conducive to the presence of special presence of tiger. Now, this is followed by a third phase, third and the fourth phase. Third phase is a crucial phase where research teams, say more than 100 young boys and girls who are trained in wildlife, who have a post-graduation in wildlife, who have a special capacity building program, who undergo a special capacity building program at the Wildlife Institute of India to analyze this data, they are sent along with camera traps and the other facilities which are needed to compute the density of tiger and the prey animals to the good source areas. Say, there are 47 tiger reserves. Mm-hmm. Around 30 of them are taken where you have a lot of abundance of tigers. They go, they stay there, and there is a closure period for the cameras, traps. They deploy the cameras in a specified sampling design, and then they capture the tiger photographs as per the protocol. They carry out the distance sampling, get the data for the ungulate prey base, and then, of course, they also gather the information relating to human disturbance if settlements are close by, and they come back to the Wildlife Institute of India.
So what we understand from this is that in phase two, that data was analyzed, which allowed us to know where to deploy camera traps, which began what is phase three of this project, where the camera traps were deployed in 30 different parks to find out where tigers are found, where the prey is found, and also where the humans are found.
Meanwhile, there is already an ongoing exercise in all these tiger reserves, barring a few where you have very low tiger presence, where you can't use camera traps. And that is called as phase four monitoring. That's done by the field managers. So they have the photo details, camera trap details, captures, rather the photographs of individual tigers, the minimum numbers they have an idea and minimum number of tigers which are there in these reserves. So that data is also collated by these research teams. They come back. And then the methodology, the analysis is known as double sampling method. First sampling phase involves the phase one where you have the 8-day protocol. The second one is where you send the research team and collect get the density data from the productive sites. And then you compute the density along with covariates using the spatially explicit mark recapture model, which is the latest model which is used to analyze the data. And you factor in the covariates as well, get the density of tiger, get the density of the prey base, and then you get the density template for the entire area where you have camera trapped.
So what we're talking about here is the statistical method in order to validate the areas that the tigers are expected to be in. The sampling that was done in phase one and the camera traps that were used in phase three form a double sample used to reduce the statistical variability.
With this relationship, with this, you calibrate, you get the idea of the tiger density areas where tigers are present, but they are present in low density where you can't use the camera traps. You are not in a position to use the camera traps. So you extrapolate them to those limited areas. Most of them you find the tigers in these 47 source areas only, but little bit they are spread outside as well. And the spatial occupancy has increased slightly in this assessment. We'll get an idea about that in a few months. They are computing that. So this is how we compute the tiger numbers at the country level. So we use the regression, simple regression to multivariate regression to establish a relationship between the density of tigers and the presence of covariates. So with that relationship, we can get an idea for those places where we could not use the camera traps. To sum up, I would say that US 1,545, and today I got an intimation that it's little more than that. Individual tiger photographs have been collected. Now, these are different tigers, that data we have. Besides this, this accounts to almost 70% of the 2,226 number, which we have said as a mid-value for the country-level tiger population.
So that tiger population number of 2,226 was derived as a calculation or an extrapolation?
Well, yes and no. As he was saying, they have actual photographs of a certain number of unique tigers, but using the density models that were developed through the analysis, they're able to figure out what the approximate number of tigers should be in those areas where they couldn't do camera traps. And that's where they get the extrapolated number.
If you go by the spatially explicit model, 1,900 tigers are taken care by that. Around 300 tigers have been computed through extrapolation. This is what I have to say about the methodology which has been used. Mm-hmm. It has been well received. Barring one criticism from Dr. Ullas Karanth and a few research associates who work with him. So they question the use of the coefficient, that is the R squared in the regression. They said that is not a good predictor, it can't give you good inference. They had recently brought out one publication, we have gone through that publication, we are sending a response to them. So the model which they have prepared is based on flawed data and bad sample design. And that's an old data which they have used, and the data also appears to be quite unrealistic in the sense they have taken it from sites where there are 17 tigers per 100 square kilometer, and so on. There are a lot of things and flaws in that. So through that model, they have put the 2011 assessment, the earlier assessment, and they have said, well, the R-squared is not a good tool to bring out a proper inference. They should go for smart methods. That was their criticism in a nutshell. But we have seen that, and it's not very well founded. So what very precise based on peer-reviewed publication as well. And moreover, the high point is 15 whatever photographs of individual tigers we have as such. And then 1900 and odd tigers we get through the specially explicit model, which also takes into consideration the additive, the joint likelihood approach, and the issues relating to detection probability. So there are no serious issues in this. It has been a very challenging and interesting exercise.
It was interesting to note that Dr. Gopal also mentioned some criticisms of the way they did the study as far as the extrapolation and the calculations go.
Right. It's important to recognize that this is still science. And because we aren't actually lining all the tigers up to count them one by one through a series of gates, we have to use statistical analysis and other methods to try and get to this number. And anytime you do so, the scientific community, the peer review community, has the opportunity to rebut, refute, and occasionally pose alternative methods to get the same thing done.
Although it sounds like, from an overall perspective, many people have accepted their methods and believe that it is a good number that they've come up with.
Well, this starts to get down into some really deep scientific questions that are more esoteric than they are pertinent for many of the audiences. For us and for the general public, yes, it's important for us to know that there's been positive progress with the tiger, but getting into an argument over multivariate analysis and coefficients is usually going to be beyond the scope of most people.
Yes, and you know, one of the things that stands out is you have tens of, you know, 10,000 people, possibly more, who are having an impact on this. Data integrity has got to be a major concern, especially given the history of conservation using things just as simple as pug marks. Now we have these very sophisticated technological capabilities, these sophisticated statistical analyses.
Yes, Dr. Will. Another thing, the sample size is terrific in the sense, around 380,000 square kilometer has been surveyed. A massive database has been created in the third such round. So it's very interesting. We could do the macro delineation of the tiger corridors. Now, those are very, very important for the in situ conservation of wild tigers in this country, elsewhere as well. Because I've been seeing the other range countries also, that it's a very serious issue. So the macro-level delineation of these corridors, that is the connectivities which link one source population to other, it's very important because that porosity of gene flow is something very crucial for these tigers to survive. The numbers are good, but then the numbers to be viable in the long run, you need this kind of connectivity. So that is the biggest challenge which we are going to face in the coming decade when we have the agenda of growth and we have the agenda of demands on the habitat for uses which may not be ecologically sustainable.
Yes, because India now has less than 5% of the world's forests, but 15% of the world's population and growing. How do you see enshrining these corridors and these wildlife parks in such a way that they can't be touched, which will allow for the tigers to survive into the future?
Well, sir, that is a very pertinent and very important question. I appreciate that. We have put in our law the imperative, the necessity for bringing out a reserve-specific tiger conservation plan. Now, this tiger conservation plan, we have elaborate guidelines on that and we vet them, and then it's a big document, gives you a roadmap for a period of 5 or 10 years, sometimes 10 years, sometimes 5 years, with the opportunity for mid-course correction. Now, this takes into account three areas. The core area, which has an exclusive tiger agenda, where you need to have an inviolate space for a viable population. By viable, I mean 20 breeding tigresses. And 20 breeding tigresses, and they are territorial animals, and sex ratio is skewed towards the females, one male to two females, and it is going towards the females. So 20 breeding females will support something like 65 to 70 animals, given the territorial advertisements, the old animals getting pushed out, the younger ones waiting in the wings to occupy territory, and the transients coming from the other source areas. So we have computed this based on empirical data, something like 65 to 70 animals thrive in a productive habitat where 20 breed tigers are there. And this requires something like 800 to 1200 square kilometers of inviolate space.
So what does he really mean by 20 tigresses supporting that space?
What he's trying to get at here is that 20 tigresses over the course of time are going to be able to have a sustaining population of anywhere between the 55 to 70 animals that he mentioned. Now, that is taking into account all of those elements of animals growing older and being born and moving out and having others that are moving into that area. But that number corresponds entirely to that area that they're referencing.
But it doesn't mention how many males that takes.
Well, you're right. It doesn't have to. If the males had it their way, they would want it to be one.
Right.
We know that there are going to be cubs that are born, and the average tigress will have anywhere between one to four cubs. And based upon mortality rate for tigers, it tends to be about 50% in the wild. 20 tigresses should be able to create a viable population of somewhere between 50 and 70.
So now that you're more than doubling the population by having going from the 20 tigresses up to a population of maybe 50 to 75 animals, how do you deal with that in area?
Well, that was the core of the question, and his response was extremely interesting.
We have been emphasizing this. So the core agenda is devoted to this. So exclusively tiger. No other land use is allowed in the core area, and there are human settlements, and we pay them. And the relocation is voluntary. We don't force them. But then there are human wildlife interface, serious interface issues, people losing their lives and the tigers getting poisoned, revenge killings. So to avoid all this, we encourage them to move voluntarily and with a good package. And that's a very, very important thing. So the biggest conservation is that. If we provide this space, no other rocket science is required, and a good protection. Now, the tigers don't stay at a place. They have the inherent quality to move out. So the outer area is again a statutory requirement called the buffer. Now, this unit is also with the tiger as a manager. So he manages this area as a buffer, arresting it at that level only, not elevating that to the level of the core, because we want the gene to flow, but not the animals need not reside there, though there are resident populations in some places like Corbett, in places like Kanha, you have tigers residing in the buffer as well. Well, buffer, you have a lot of people. There is no law to remove people from the buffer. So the biggest challenge is to have the address the co-occurrence agenda. There can be no coexistence with these great cats, because cats, the demands are different. In humans, the demands are, they have conflict with these cats. And there's a tremendous livestock all around, and people take them out in the forest areas. These forests are light burdened as well. People go to the forest floor, picking up twigs to light the day-to-day kitchen and all that. So there is an issue. So addressing the human-tiger interface is the main agenda, and also providing ecologically sustainable livelihood options to local people. And one way of doing that, what we have done is under Project Tiger, around 25 lakh mandates are supported in the country under this Project Tiger, which covers all the 47 tiger reserves. Now, these local people, the local workforce, they assist the staff in perambulating, patrolling the area. They assist the staff in the tourism zone. They assist the staff in taking care of the barrier. So they become the primary stakeholders. And this happens in most of the reserves, barring places like Ranthambore, places like Sariska, where they have some loss where they can't deploy them the way other reserves are deploying. But then in those places, you do have problems. So this is the agenda for the buffer.
So it's a little unclear what he's talking about here with the core and the buffer.
For these large areas that the tigers are inhabiting, there is a centralized area. That's the core. That is the highest value area for the tigers to survive, their highest, most successful habitat. And then everything that is around this core is a buffer zone. It is literally between the stronghold of the tiger and the rest of the human world. And what they're doing here is remarkable because, as we've talked about before, if the cats can be more valuable alive than dead, then there's a reason to conserve them. And so they have recruited people who are near the core or in the buffer zone to become stewards of the cats in their local areas, therefore not only providing them with a sustainable existence, but also being ecologically sound to the animals in which they're taken care of.
Beyond the buffer, and that corridor is not part of the tiger reserve. So we have a provision in the law where areas linking one reserve or one protected area to another reserve, another protected area, cannot be diverted for ecologically unsustainable purpose, but with the permission and for national interest, with the due approval of the tiger authority and so on and so forth. So there is a process. So these areas are in check. And also, apart from these legal provisions, the most important thing is we have given them a prescription. What sort of forestry operations, what sort of industries or something should happen, should not happen. To cut the long story short, these corridors and buffers are not areas for development. You can't develop these areas for industry. You can't develop them for any big infrastructural thing. But there are some linear infrastructure like roadways, railways. They exist. They have been existing there since the last 100 years. So there you have mitigation measures. There are some dams, like in South India, you have the huge dam, Periyar Dam, in the Periyar Tiger Reserve. It's 150 year old. So you can throw away those dams or those roads, which are very old. So in such areas, we have prescribed mitigation. But we have said it clear, made it clear that it's for no new project should be taken up in these areas, which are either buffer or which have been delineated as corridors for tiger gene flow.
For anyone who has been following the saga of the tiger's recovery, this is really amazing news to think that we have gotten to a point where the Indian government has actually put in place sufficient laws that are going to not only control the growth in these tiger parks, but also prescribe any future growth through a series of legal challenges and legal maneuvers is really a sign of progress and bodes extremely well for the sustainability of being able to keep these populations on a positive growth trajectory. Our conversation with Dr. Gopal continues next week with more information from the front lines of tiger conservation in India, as well as perspectives on poaching and his unique experiences with the big cats.
CFAR Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At CFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
Send us your thoughts. You can get us on email via contact@cflar.org.
Tune in again next week for more discussion. My name is Asla Gonser.
And I'm Simba Wiltz. Thanks for listening to CFAR Sounding.